And you know, I think that often to really get in touch with our deep desires, we have to first starve our lesser appetites.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? And welcome to the second episode of The White Flag. Woo woo, let's go. Listen, this is a podcast for people who are trying to get off the endless treadmill of spiritual exhaustion and find joy and rest by surrendering to Jesus, especially amidst the hurried, manic, control-obsessed world that we live in. I'm your host, Jonathan Moynihan, and I'm so excited that you're here tuning in for the second full episode. Listen, I've said before that I'm not the expert on this. I want to help people adopt a lifestyle of surrender to Jesus. And I've been transformed by these ancient practices that we'll talk about over the span of the show. But there are people who I think are experts. And one of my goals is to do interviews on a monthly basis, pretty much, with people who I am learning from. And I want to help you learn from as well. And when I started this project, there was a guy up in Brooklyn who I've followed for a couple years now. And I thought, man, maybe one day this guy will get on my show and I could get him to let me interview him for the podcast. And so I just kind of stepped out and slid in his DMs a couple months back and just told him my story, told him my heart, told him the goal of the show. And he said yes. And so today we're going to get to jump into that conversation together because he was willing to give me some time, even though I'm a nobody here from Baltimore. And to me, he's just a rock star of what does it look like to navigate, you know, surrender to Jesus amidst the pull and pace of our world today. His name is Tyler Staton. He's a pastor up in Brooklyn who's actually taking a new position in Portland later this year. And there's a lot I could say about it, but I'll let him tell you about himself as we jump into the episode. But hey, once again, thank you so much for tuning in. I'm going to get out of here so we can jump into this conversation today. And I hope it challenges you and inspires you to know and walk with Jesus the way it did when I got to hear it the first time. Let's jump in. Here we are with our first interview of the White Flag Podcast, just conversations about surrendering to Jesus in our context, kind of coming to the end of yourself and realizing this is the start of what apprenticeship to Jesus really looks like. And I'm really excited to be here with my first ever guest and really a pastor crush of mine for a long time now, Tyler Staton from Oaks Church, Brooklyn. And he's not on this because he released a new book, but he did release a new book. Tyler, real quick, this isn't going to be the brunt of our conversation, but what's the problem you're trying to solve with Searching for Enough, the high wire walk between doubt and faith?
It's basically, first of all, really glad to be here and to meet you, man. Thanks for inviting me on. What I'm trying to solve is that the Western church is hemorrhaging a couple generations of people that my church just happens to be reaching. And I think that's mainly because the church is still answering questions that previous generations were asking. Wow. And the questions have changed. And so the way that you answer the questions has to change as well. So honestly, like, this is probably not the best way to plug a book, but I don't have anything new in there. I've got the same old story of just trying to point people to Jesus, but I'm approaching it from angles that I think are relatively new within the church in this hemisphere, at least. And so I just found that the way that we were articulating the gospel, the same old gospel story, was having real resonance with people that were flooding the exit doors of the mainstream American church. And so just trying to offer this as a gift to the broader church and invite people to encounter with Jesus. There's kind of three people I have in mind when I was writing it. One is the lost, those outside of relationship with Jesus. Second is those on the road to Emmaus, people that have left the church, not cynical, but disappointed. Just like, man, I thought there would be life here. And I'm starting to grapple with the fact that maybe there's not, or maybe there's not life abundantly like Jesus talks about. Yeah. And the last is just the bored, you know, people that are sitting in church pews and are just bored. Like they're going to church, they're doing the thing, but the truth is their imagination is captured by something else. It's more captive to their career trajectory or their favorite sports team or their hobby or whatever it may be. So yeah, that's the quick book plug. Now let's talk about what you want to talk about.
Listen, man, it all integrates, right? Because the whole premise of this show is to kind of help people see, like, the ultimate superpower of the Christian walk is having courageous surrender. Like, realizing even in the Christian walk, we operate out of human striving so often, and yet the real connection with God that taps into that, what is this abundant life the church promises? Why am I not experiencing it? It really comes down to coming to the end of ourself. So my first question for you really was, I know you went to Moody in Chicago, and you moved to New York in 2012? Something like that?
No, I was here and then left for 3 months, then came back. So if you count it all, I moved here summer 2009.
Okay, right on. So summer 2009. Now, the projection I make about you, the story I tell myself, is that you've always been this young leader of deep contemplative faith. You know, you always adopted these practices, but I imagine...
That's the story.
Okay, always...
No, I'm just kidding.
Always perfect. You know, but I imagine, you know, transitioning to New York, one of the most hurried, most progressive, you're in Brooklyn, one of the most progressive parts of one of the most progressive cities. Mm-hmm. There has to have been a formation period and then even a mutation period of how you've pursued and adopted some of these old school, keep it simple, rest in Jesus and see what the Spirit does. Can you walk me through what your development has been, even pursuing things like silence and solitude and wordless prayer and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think there's been, I guess, three key moments of coming to the end of myself as you're articulating it. The first is, so when I first moved to New York City, I was tasked to start a youth ministry for the church plant that hired me. And I just so happened that the teenagers I got to know, because this church had no parents of teenagers. It was more like, there's a demographic that we're not reaching and we want to begin reaching them, but we kind of need you to plant a church for teens. And we're going to start from there and try to reach families through first reaching teenagers. And that was really fun. It was really exciting. I was 22 years old at that point, but the kids that I was getting to know were all first generation immigrants living beneath the poverty line. In low-income housing. And so for 5 years, I ministered it to that context. So I remember when I started the youth ministry, I started with 8 kids, 2 of whom I was one-on-one discipling all of them. 2 of them had become believers. 6 of them were pretty sure they weren't really into this stuff, but they liked hanging.
Yeah, sure.
And had never heard of something like a youth group. And so as I was discipling them and as we began to like form this youth group and I started doing teaching and stuff, I had this incredible privilege, and that was to form their first impression of Jesus. Because that, you know, for instance, I would teach the story of the feeding of the 5,000 and no one in the room had ever heard it before.
Wow.
So it wasn't like reframing it. It was like, I'm literally giving the first impression of this. And so I think I did a lot of thinking during those 5 years on, what is Jesus and what is American church culture? And what do I want to give to these kids that I think will help them come alive in this world, eternally alive? And what is kind of just like neutral? You know, this is just stuff that got stuck to Jesus in a particular culture, in a particular context, at a particular time. So that was a really important process for me to walk through. And then a story that would take away from the heart of the question you're asking, I transitioned that ministry to someone else, moved across the river to Brooklyn, planted a church. And what is kind of like the quintessential, like progressive, artistic neighborhood in all of New York City, it's called Williamsburg. And in Williamsburg, there's 0.1% church attendance, Catholic, Protestant, or evangelical. So 1 out of every 1,000 people attends some kind of Christian church. Your average Sunday,
you are amongst the unchurched of the unchurched, like post-Christian, post everything up there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it is like deep unreached people group levels of statistics here. And
wow.
And yeah, I was really excited to minister here. That kind of thing excites me. And we planted this church and things were going better than we ever thought they would go and all the measurables and stuff. But this is what I discovered. I kind of hit a quiet crisis point
Okay.
because the burden was heavy.
Yeah.
And I can remember having these conversations with Jesus where I was like, either you're a fraud or I'm doing this wrong.
Wow.
Because this is all going quite well. But you said the yoke would be easy and the burden is light. And
Huh.
the yoke is hard and the burden is heavy. And I keep reading the New Testament and it just seems like they're having a different experience than what I'm having. And I would like that experience. And so that I think when you reach the end of yourself, one of two things happens. When you get to, or what I would call like desperate, when you get to desperation,
Yeah.
you either then like really start to experience the presence and power of God, or you retreat back to things that worked for you before.
Yes, 100%.
And I got to a point where I just got comfortable. Maybe I got so uncomfortable, so dissatisfied with retreating back to things that worked for me before that I started, I don't know of a better way to say this. I started leading naked. And so I basically felt like God calling me to do things in a certain, in such a way that he would need to show up. And none of them are formulaic. They were just invitations from the Spirit to me. And they were really about dismantling my idols. So I, for instance, this is one example, things like this would happen all the time. I remember this one particular week where I just heard the whisper of the Holy Spirit right at the beginning of the week. For this week's sermon, you only get one page.
Whoa,
And I was
yeah,
like,
that's not
what?
comfortable for a preacher.
Yeah, I was like, what do you mean? Is that like pastorally negligent? Am I just playing games with the people I'm supposed to be teaching the Bible to at that point? And I just, as I processed that with God, I just heard him so clearly say to me, like, no, this isn't about the people. This is about you. Like, you love to preach good sermons. And therefore,
So a good thing that builds the kingdom. This is important for people to hear, can become idolatrous because we make it the ultimate thing instead of just a tool.
Yeah, that's what an idol is. An idol is a good thing made an ultimate thing.
Yeah.
So an idol is anything. An idol is booze, pornography, or sermon prep,
Yeah.
and everything in between.
Tyler, come on. That is good. That's so, it's true though. And like people who are not necessarily in ministry can't fathom having good work or work of the kingdom become something that is actually toxic or harmful, but it's absolutely true. It's why you see burnout the way it is. It starts virtuous and becomes toxic over time in our own heart.
Yeah, so I just basically then, yeah, felt God saying to me, so look, this means too much to you. You love the feeling of preaching good sermons even more than you love to rely on me and to bear fruit that lasts.
Wow.
And you love the affirmation of the Father, but you'll settle for the praise of man. And I think that often
Wow.
to really get in touch with our deep desires, we have to first starve our lesser appetites. It's kind of like if I was to say to you, like, okay, Jonathan, listen, man, I've got this like grass-fed filet mignon that I can give you tomorrow, but you have to fast until then, and you're going to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Or I can give you this McDonald's cheeseburger right now,
Yeah.
and it's so hard not to eat the fast food because fast food takes away the feeling of being hungry, but
Yeah.
it does not nourish your body,
That's
right? Like everyone knows this isn't healthy for me. This isn't like actually delivering. Hunger is telling me my body needs nourishment. I can make the hunger go away without nourishing my body. So I can write the good talk, present something that people think is good, and then maybe even a few people come up to me afterwards and say, oh, that one point when you said this, that was so great. And me just feel like, wow, man, what a fruitful day for the kingdom without actually giving people things, something that will nourish them. What will nourish people is if I become so empty that the Spirit of God can flow through me like I'm an empty vessel, like I'm a pipe. you know, that's just like heaven to earth, and God is flowing through it.
Wow.
And so, one particular Sunday, I just heard God say, you've only got one page, and don't worry. It's actually not about the people. I can feed the people. It's about you. I can't feed you what will satisfy you because you keep eating fast food.
Wow.
So I'm asking you to starve that. And so there's things like that, like God calling me to acts of obedience, ways of fasting, ways of starving lesser appetites.
Wow.
So that I could hunger for greater things. And then the third point that became really helpful.
Wow.
So I would say during that period, I really became more charismatic. I began to experience more of the power of the Holy Spirit. And I have no idea who's going to listen to this. So charismatic may be like a curse word or something.
No, unpack it briefly if you could.
Yeah.
I definitely have an audience where people who are dabbling in Jesus, they're on the outer skirts of that discipleship crowd. They're not sure if they want to look in, so I don't want vocabulary to be an off-ramp for them.
Sure. So for people that are really into all the vocabulary, I would describe myself as charismatic, not Pentecostal.
Yeah.
For normal people that have no idea what that means, I would say the central claim of the New Testament is that because of the resurrection of Jesus, there's an eternal kind of life that is loose in the world. And that eternal kind of life is a free gift that is accessible to anyone. And when I say eternal kind of life, I do mean a kind of life that lasts forever, that defeats death.
Yeah.
But I also mean a quality of life, like an eternal quality of life where you can come so alive that you are bearing fruit that is beyond your capacity to bear in the lives of others in the world. And so... I think that much of the American church, to be completely honest, like all of us have express beliefs and core beliefs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the express belief of the American church would be Jesus is the head of the church and he builds his church.
Mm-hmm.
The core belief of the American church would be we need novel ideas, new strategies, and really innovative tools, and that builds the church. Great teachers build the church. Great leaders build the church. Great ideas build the church. And so I think to begin to discover ministry by the power of the Holy Spirit was just essentially to make my express belief my core belief, that the greatest thing I can do is become emptied out so that God can pour through me.
Mm.
And that to incarnate a kind of life that is truly life becomes a more powerful tool for him than to spend all of my time coming up with new ideas and strategies, that kind of thing.
Wow.
So maybe one other example to try to flesh that out a little bit. It's like one of the fruits of the Spirit is joy.
Yeah.
And everyone is born with the capacity for joy that God gives them. It's why a small child can run around their backyard and they don't need anything else. Like a kid is never like, man, it's a sunny day. You know what would make this complete? Like a beer and a few friends. A kid is like, I can run around outside and look at the sky and play. Like a kid can find anything and be so full of joy.
Yeah.
But then as we get older, we start to attach things to that and we begin to access a cheapened version of joy through things we can consume. So a cheapened version of that for 28-year-old Tyler would be like, it's Friday evening and I'm having like a happy hour burger and beer special with a couple of friends. That is, I'm tasting something that was similar to joy, but it is not the same because it's the fast food thing again. So I starved those kinds of appetites and I began to access childlike joy in an adult body, you know? And so that's what I mean about becoming useful to God in that way.
Wow.
And then the last stage is, I've spent the last 3 years attending an incredible program called the Transforming Center. It's taught by a woman named Ruth Haley Barton, who
I love. Ruth Haley Barton. She I read Restoring the Soul of Your Leadership before I read Invitation to Silence and Solitude. So I kind of did it backwards, but her work put language to like the wounds of my heart and the longing of my spirit and really kind of gave me community as I navigated some of this stuff alone, which is part of the reason why this podcast exists, to help people not feel alone who are kind of transitioning in this beautiful shift of how they view following Jesus. But she's great. Yeah.
Yeah. So Ruth and her teaching have been huge in my life. They've really given me a larger toolbox for accessing the power of the Spirit. You know, the desert fathers and mothers, which would be the earliest Christian kind of apostolic figures after the Bible, their primary access point to the power of the Holy Spirit was not like the chorus of their favorite worship song. It was silence.
Yep.
And so I would just say, like, I'm for all of them. That's why I'm just a broader toolbox. I love to sing praise to Jesus.
Yeah.
And I love to sit alone in silence. And I think that those kinds of things, like what you've talked about going on this journey with silence and solitude, contemplative prayer, these things, they're just a greater toolbox for different ways to know and access the power and presence of God in your life. So those are kind of, sorry, that was such a long-winded answer.
Oh, man.
But those are the pieces of my journey that have, I think, equipped me to minister in the way that I minister right now.
Yeah, it's not unusual as I'm discussing this with more and more people, even reading the work of others, that there is this moment of not deconstruction the way the word is being used in our context now, but almost I would call a healthy deconstruction of, like you said, those idols, those pillars that we've propped our faith up on, almost building on sand in some ways, instead of on the rock of just who Jesus is, and none of the frills or even the strategies that we do to exalt him, which are good things, but we can't become the ultimate thing. So I one of the tensions I'm trying to navigate in this podcast and in this platform is to sort of normalize some of these pursuits. I know that speaking about them without practicality could come off as pretentious. I know that, of just, just be quiet. And we are right by DC, Baltimore. More than 50% of our church, our community at least, has a graduate degree or higher. Fort Meade and NSA, all the people who read your emails are right down the street. We're a hyper-educated community. So just saying, well, be still, be quiet, sit around. Like that just does not compute, literally, with like the binary folks in our church who just do coding. And so I want to provide some practices to help them. And even in an upcoming message that I'm doing, I'm trying to break that down into what does rest in the presence of God look like. But for you leading in Brooklyn, in one of the most hurried cities on earth, it's one of the few environments that can kind of talk down to our environment and say, hey, listen, if we can do it here, you can do it there. What are some practical things that you've seen from your leaders, from yourself, like on a real, almost imitatable level, so that I could just see what Tyler's doing and then maybe I could imitate that? Is there anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, I think like within the contemplative sphere, the most effective thing we've done is we've created a daily prayer rhythm. Okay. Traditionally, it would just be called praying the offices or fixed hour prayer. And for us, that consists with morning, midday, and evening prayers. So like, you know, everyone can make that fit for their schedule, but approximately like 7 a.m., 1 p.m., 7 p.m. kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the reason is because the reason that that's formative to stop and pray at different points in the day, which, by the way, Jesus prayed by a daily prayer rhythm. Like all the scholarship that we have shows that the Hebrew people observed a morning, midday, and evening prayer rhythm. Jesus observed that as well. And the early church observed that. The documents have been recovered from the early church show that they gathered morning, midday, and evening to pray together in community. That's actually why when you read the book of Acts, things happen like Peter and John get released from the Sanhedrin after getting flogged. And they're almost immediately that same day gathered with the whole church in the temple for a prayer meeting. It's like, how do they do that in a world before cell phones and email? How did they get everyone together the same day?
Yeah.
Because they were getting together anyway. And so they had this set rhythm of life. But the reason our starting place was for the why behind praying the offices or daily prayer rhythm was not discipline. It was love.
Okay.
It is like you. So if you watch any great rom-com,
yeah,
then the director will often show you, like, the whole movie will be about, like, the early stages of romance.
Yes.
When there's passion and excitement and everything.
Yeah.
And then oftentimes, like in the movie The Notebook, for instance, mm-hmm. then there'll be an old couple at the end, and it will show you, like, love in its most mature stage. And everyone, when they see that last scene, is like, I want that.
Yeah.
Now, the trouble is, and the reason that the director shows you only the beginning and the end is because fidelity is boring. So fidelity is boring. So no one documents that. That's why the only people that make movies about that middle stage of marriage are people making, like, dark, brooding indie films that don't resolve, you know, but the truth is that the middle years are when love is fought for and when it's won and lost, right? Everyone can experience that young fire and passion, but not everyone gets to experience love that's fully grown in the end.
Yeah.
Those who fight for love in the years when they are raising kids and having a career and falling apart and making mistakes and all that stuff, that's where love is won and lost. And so most people know the early stage of relationship to Jesus,
yeah,
but they don't know the pathway to deep, rich communion with him. Wow. They only know most people's best stories came in their spiritual infancy when God met them and they were alive. And
so, right.
and then they got knee deep in the water, and it's like an infinity pool that you can, like, frolic in down the deep end.
Yeah.
But they got knee deep in the water and they just assume, like, I guess this is it.
Yeah.
And so I think that something like a daily prayer of them is a way to say, like, here's a way to choose fidelity, and not to choose it in a moment when you're inspired by a sermon, but to keep choosing it every day. I'm going to keep going.
Yep.
Just to keep choosing it day in and day out as you keep seeking Jesus. And so that was where our starting place was love. And then secondly, I think kind of the need that people have is, why would you stop three times a day in the middle of your day to pray to Jesus? Like, yeah, why would someone who's writing code have a little alarm that goes off on their watch and then slip out of their office building for a 5-minute prayer time at 1 p.m.
Yeah.
And then come back to their desk and keep doing the same thing. And I would say, because what orders your day right now?
Mm-hmm.
And is it delivering you deep satisfaction? Mm. Most people's days are ordered by maybe their work demands, like maybe your inbox mm-hmm. and it orders your day. Maybe it's mealtimes, you know, maybe it's just like you're working to get to lunch and then working to get to dinner.
Sure.
Maybe it's the weekends, or for many people it would be their device or their phone, mm-hmm. you know, like who's interacting with them.
Yeah.
But what if your day was ordered around communion with Jesus?
That's great.
Like, what if you met with him in the morning and the thing that you looked forward to was escaping with him at midday? And then what if on the way home, instead of littering your dinner table in your living room with the unresolved tension of the day, you knew Jesus in such a way that you processed that so with him and left it with him so that you could be present with the people that you love the most, like truly present. And so our church started this daily prayer rhythm, and we created an app to remind people, and we gave them some guidance on what to pray about in the morning, what to pray about at midday, and what to pray about in the evening. And all that guidance came from different ancient prayers that have been passed down to us through our Christian tradition, and found that people really discovered that what felt like discipline at first
mm-hmm.
became love the more they did it. And they discovered that they actually a lot of people know that they feel loved by God and that they therefore love God.
Yeah.
But as people began to commune with Jesus throughout the day, what they discovered was, I actually really like God. Like, I enjoy his company. And I think he likes me. I think he enjoys my company and enjoys being with me. So that would be, you know, one I would offer is just praying a morning, midday, and evening office. Wow. That can be done in 30 seconds or 30 minutes.
Yeah.
But just beginning to order your day around communion with Jesus as a practiced form of fidelity for deepening your relationship with him.
That's great. I found myself, as I was on this journey of really pursuing these things, getting frustrated with the phrase breakthrough that gets used a lot in church world. Because I have found that like these rhythms of just being faithful, doing the right thing over and over again, fidelity to the Lord, that is what's producing the fruit more than like sort of throwing a Hail Mary and hoping for a big experience. So even this practice you're saying of praying consistently, even when I don't feel like it, this manifests itself in marriage, you know, like choosing to be romantic with your wife and take her out and do gifts and acts of service and all these things. If we were to only be motivated to do them when we felt it, it wouldn't go too well, obviously. Even the idea of friendship with Jesus. My first monastery experience was like 96 hours of silence, zero interaction. I had a Bible and a journal in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And after, I found myself longing to go to these quiet places because God was my friend. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to articulate that well. So I'm so glad that you articulated what you can do to get there. But it's difficult to be like, okay, I want to delight in the woods. I'm going to sit and literally just have like commune with God and not bring all the worst things into my life, but just talk to him about even like the small things, because the level in which he went to redeem me reveals like he wants to be involved in my life. He isn't some passive father who doesn't want to be around, but the friendship aspect of it, I hadn't thought of that word fidelity, but that perfectly captures like some of what I have experienced. And part of the reason I want to learn from you and others is to increase my vocabulary, to help articulate and help people understand what is on the other side of this. If they can have the, not discipline is what I would have said, but love to lean in and make this a priority.
Yeah. And discipline is a part of love. Like even as you compared it to marriage, Ronald Rollheiser has this tiny little book called Domestic Monastery.
Okay.
Where he basically says that the rhythms of a mom with young children are really similar to the rhythms of a monk living in a monastery. And so it's a beautiful book. If you're a mom with young kids listening to this and you want to know, how am I supposed to connect with Jesus when my toddler is constantly like tugging at me?
Yeah.
Read that book. But there's this one chapter in there where he talks about a wedding charge that Dietrich Bonhoeffer was famous for giving, where he would say, right now, it's your wedding day. You're young and in love, and you think your love can sustain your marriage. It can't. Your marriage has to sustain your love.
Yeah.
So take the commitments that you're making today and live them day in and day out, and that will keep your love alive, not the other way around.
That's great.
And so that's kind of what we're talking about. And even, you know, I think so many people have trouble accessing some of the ancient disciplines, like you're talking about silence, because they think it's supposed to produce something, right? If I'm silent with God, then I guess he's supposed to speak to me prophetically, or I'm supposed to like have a revelation. But the truth is it's sometimes that happens, but most of the time it's about friendship. Like you were talking about, it's like the people that you know really well, you can be silent with. Like you can go on you can take a drive and you don't need to talk. But you can talk at any point, something comes up, but then you can go 20 minute stretches with no one saying a word and no one feels awkward because you become at ease in each other's presence. So it's to practice silence is to practice being at ease in the presence of God and then not be awkward.
Yeah.
So if all you do is wait 10 minutes and nothing happens, you're just learning to be at ease in the presence of God. That's like a great use of your life. That's a great use of 10 minutes. You know?
That even hijacks the story that like, you know, young couples tell about that old couple at the end of the restaurant and they're not even talking to each other. Oh, they must be miserable. But learning from the Lord, it's like, oh no, they're actually more comfortable and more in love and more safety in their relationship than the impulse that we need to fill every space or whip out our phones or or do all those things. There's mm-hmm. something in that. I mean, obviously marriage being this ultimate example of covenant for us is so good, but man, that's perfect. That's such a good way to look at it. So I guess before I let you go, Tyler, one of my last questions before the very, very last one is, mm-hmm. I was talking about this with a really informed, educated friend, and they were bringing up this tension they feel of not wanting to push people. If we were to advocate for these ancient practices, you know, there's some people could even articulate there's like a Eurocentricity to it, because like some cultural expressions are very vibrant and animated. But you know, there's the Western idea of contemplation being this quiet, still thing. And then even people who have personality dispositions that like, okay, it's easy for them to zag. So the Holy Spirit's going to tell them to zig or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
But I struggle with that a little bit, because when I look at Jesus, he supplants any pre-existing heritage and says, no, imitate me, do as I do. So what would you say to that, to someone who maybe is like super expressive and they want to connect to God that way, or someone who maybe is naturally very quiet and silence isn't difficult for them, the way it, you know, as an extrovert, recovering people pleaser, 7 on the Enneagram, silence kills me, but it also has saved me. But for someone who maybe is already silent or has a cultural background that makes it even, it almost feels less confronting. How would you approach that to someone who maybe is a little different than the normal Western starving, drowning, you know, striver?
Sure. Yeah, I would say, first of all, I would not describe myself as a contemplative. I would describe myself as a charismatic contemplative.
Okay.
So I am all for, like, I will dance at the front of the church as we're singing songs. I am expressive in the core of my being when it comes to worshiping God. So I would just say I'm for all of it.
That's great.
And I think that anyone that feels like there's a sophistication bias in the contemplative tradition, or there's privilege wrought within it or something, I would just say, I think that's a fair critique. And I think that critique comes, unfortunately, from the fact that we have made complicated things that aren't complicated. Like, it's just like we were talking about before. People, you know, we talk about being at ease in the presence of God, mm-hmm. and we call it contemplation. And so it sounds really complicated.
And it sounds like we're doing something, like we have the secret formula, we know what to say. And as you pointed out, it's just sit for 10 minutes.
Right. And in fact, everyone does this. Everyone practices contemplation in relationship with others, just by learning to be at ease in the presence of someone. So these are actually, we need to change or redeem some terminology and demystify these things.
Yeah.
That's part of it. Secondly, I would say everyone has spiritual pathways that they know about, and spiritual maturity is discovering new ones often.
That's great.
So many people would, like, honestly, I love the Bible. Like, I love to read the Bible, and I love to read other people's writing on the Bible. So it's easy for me to meet Jesus that way. That feels like a clear pathway. But it also keeps me in the shallow end of the pool if that's the only way I know how to meet Jesus. I'm minimizing him, and I'm minimizing my experience of him. And what I've discovered, and what I hear you saying when you describe your personality type and everything, is that it's often the spiritual practices that make you most uncomfortable at first that you treasure most in the end. But it doesn't happen quickly, right? Like, one of my primary spiritual pathways today is fasting. Fasting has been a huge part of my life in the last 5 years. And in the 28 years prior to that, it was almost never a part of my life. And I didn't fast one time and think, this is freaking awesome, I got to do this all the time. You know, it was more like,
yeah,
I tried to respond to God's invitations and learn to pray with my body.
Mm-hmm.
Learn to let my body, my stomach growl, and know that that is a cry to God on behalf of the hungry. And somewhere over time, that became one of the most treasured ways that I meet with God, and a key practice in my life. So I guess I would just say, if you know your spiritual pathways, that's beautiful. Keep connecting with God that way. And don't assume that those are the only ways God meets you.
That's great.
Because God wants to meet you 1,000 different ways. And if you follow him over the course of your life, then you'll go through phases and they're all going to be good. You're going to go through phases of high praise and phases of deep spiritual friendship and phases of scripture reading and discovering, phases of contemplative prayer and phases of fiery intercession. And they're all good. They're just like onion at like layer after layer of the onion of discovering who he is. So I guess I would just say I'm down with all of it.
That's
just
so helpful.
Keep getting in there. You know?
That's so helpful. Because it's a genuine tension I wanted to navigate as I talk about this with more and more people. I know you're leaving. Last question. How can we be praying for Kirsten and Hank and Simon as you navigate the next couple months? Just give us a quick thing.
Oh, man.
I'm praying for you because I know you got to hop off.
Thank you for asking that. It's so kind. Yeah, we're navigating a massive change. My family is about to be moving from New York City to Portland, Oregon to take over leadership of a new community. So I think for myself and my wife, Kirsten, we're processing a ton of grief and a ton of gratitude at the same time. The 12 years we've spent in New York have been the richest of our lives. And so I walk around this place and there's milestones of ways and places that I've met Jesus everywhere. It's just like landmarks all over the place. And so I want to savor all of that, all of how good God's been to me here. And there's grief, like saying goodbye to our closest friends and people that we've gone through stages of life with and everything, saying goodbye to the community that I helped plant and love has been, it's tough. So I think I'm asking that God would just lead us on that journey thoroughly, because I know that I have a lot to grieve. And if it doesn't come out of me now, it's going to come out of me sometime. Yeah. And so I guess I'm just asking God to gently, but clearly lead me by the hand on this journey to move from one place to another and one calling to another. And for my kids, there's this phrase that shows up in a couple different Psalms. You've set my feet down in a broad place. Okay. That's my prayer for my kids through this, is I just want God to set their feet down in a broad place. And I don't mean that in any literal sense. I just mean in a spiritual sense where they have more room to roam, more room to grow up, more room to be themselves, more room to discover him, more room to have fun, more, you know, there's environments where space is made for me to be myself, discover who I am, discover God, discover others. And I'm hoping that, while Brooklyn has represented that for them, and I'm hoping that Portland just represents an increase of that for them. So that's for Hank, who's about to turn 5, and Simon, who's about to turn 3. To anyone listening, I believe in prayer. So if you'd pray for them, I would love that.
Great. You got it, man. Well, thank you so much, Tyler, for giving us your time. Bro, be blessed, be well, be in good health. I'm rooting for you. You are ministering to me here in Baltimore and affecting people just with how you pursue Jesus. So thank you so much for your time, man. I feel undeserved for your time and the wisdom that you shared with me today. I could not have asked for a better kickoff to this thing. So thank you.
Thanks, brother. Much love to you. It's so good to meet the kindred spirit out there.
That's right,
dude. And hopefully this isn't the last time we chat.
Yeah. I'll let you get settled in on the West Coast for a while and then I'll come calling again. All right, buddy.
All right.
See ya.
All right. Peace, man.